Hello all, welcome to the God Said of Us podcast. This is Patrick Barney. I'm the editor of Kai Draconis Books, and the God Said of Us podcast is a content channel of Kai Draconis Books. Kai Draconis Books is an independent anarchist press dedicated to publishing socially conscious literature. So today we're doing something a little slightly different. So as for those of you who've listened before, you know that I get together with my friends Hans Berger and Chris Malmberg, and we discuss, some kind of work that one of us has picked out, and we read it and we talk about it. And then on other occasions, when the press publishes a book or is about to publish a book, I will interview the author of that book and we'll chat about it. However, since the next book that the press is publishing is my book, and that the name of it is Misfit the Wanderer, and it's going to be released in, the official release date is 2 days from now, but we had a delay at the printer, so it's actually not going to ship out until maybe it's going to ship from the printer at the 18th, then it'll come to me, and then, you know, so around the 19th or the 20th, I'll start to ship the books out to people who have, you know, donated to our Kickstarter campaign. So that's what we're going to do today. Hans and Chris are essentially going to interview me about the book. So stay tuned and let's hear what they have to say. Over to you, Hans and Chris.
All right. So I guess the first thing I just wanted to say, I don't know if I can, maybe this is going to come across as a little self-absorbed the way that I'm framing it, or, you know, maybe like I'm kissing ass, but I was thinking when I was reading this book, I have a friend that I hang out with sometimes that I work with, and she is a reasonably optimistic, reasonably sunny person by nature, and I feel sometimes like sort of a dour, cranky sourpuss, you know, and I hadn't realized totally. At some point, she just kind of said, you know, man, you just kind of talk shit about everything all the time. And I kind of had to step back and evaluate, do I do that and how I feel about that? And I realized that part of the reason that she has that perception of me is most of the stuff we talk about has to do with my job, or it has to do with politics, or it has to do with things that I can't have unambiguously good opinions about, but there are a certain number of things that do actually make me really happy, and one of them is knowing that things like this are being made and put out in the world, and like that art that exists with this kind of ambition and purity is there, and people are still trying to do it, and people are still trying to present it, and it, I don't know, it's just something that makes me feel very good about the world. For all the darkness and sadness of the work itself, the fact that it was made with the care and attention that was clearly put into it, and then the fact that you've been brave enough to put it out, at the risk of seeming like a sycophant, that warms my heart in a very basic way. So, thank you.
I'm flattered, Hans. Thank you.
Yeah. So as far as questions go, the first thing that I was just kind of wondering about is, so to some extent, this is a novel about addiction, and there's a parallel fixation that the character of Misfit has with a video game. And I guess we should say here, I anticipate that the questions that I do have planned to ask are going to pretty much run all through the course of the plot of the novel, so you know, anyone who, I would advise anyone who's going to listen to the podcast probably to read the novella first. That's pretty much always true of what we do, but in this case it's something that is going to be coming out right around the time of the podcast, so you know, I'm going to be pitching questions and having a conversation with the assumption that the listenership basically understands the characters and knows what happens in the plot, so if that works for you guys.
Yeah. That's good. Before you go on, Hans, just a note to readers, all the books that Kai Draconis publishes are free. So if you want to read Misfit the Wanderer, all you got to do is go to our website and order the book, and it's yours for free. So the this is not necessarily a plug for you to, you know, give us money or anything. So go on, Hans.
Not a plug for them to give you money, but a plug for them to give you attention, I suppose.
Yeah, that's true. Give me attention.
So to some extent, this is a novel about addiction, about drug addiction. The character Misfit, of course, is a pot dealer. It smokes a great deal of marijuana. To some extent, that habit has hurt his relationship with his parents. I don't know how much that's symptom. I don't know how much the drug use is symptomatic of deeper problems with his life and society versus how much it's a causal factor. But at the same time, he also has this parallel fixation with video gaming. And I just wonder, is addiction a good paradigm to think about Misfit's relationship to video games, or is it oversimplified to say that? Does that question make sense? Like, what is the lens through which we should understand his use of video games as a critique, as a social critique, or as a critique of something else?
Well, hopefully his obsession or love of video games is multi-layered, and I think there's hopefully I've been successful in, like, you know, making you think about the video game on several different levels, and one of those levels I hope is to think of it as an addiction.
Sure. What other levels do you think? What other levels should we be thinking about it on?
Well, another thing I'm interested in is the ambiguity of fantasy, and how it can be both empowering and like a handicap. Like, you know, so on one level we've got an addiction that clearly, you know, fucks up his life, but on another, you know, I think there's maybe channeled in some different way, fantasies can be empowering if Misfit were able to do it somehow differently.
I had a question that kind of maybe jumped onto that. Are video games meant to be distinct in any way from other fictional media, or is it really like storytelling and fiction in general that could serve this purpose? Play that role.
Play which role?
I was thinking of I guess just sort of jumping off of like a later. I was trying to sort of contextualize what it seemed Misfit was getting from video games, and I made a note for myself. The difference between the real and the authentic, the real being what we experience, is that we map onto fiction the real in order to immerse the reader, viewer, gamer, the authentic being the persistent, unbridgeable gap between experience and meaning. That probably doesn't make a lot of sense, but basically, like, the characters in this novella, if they're in Misfit's meat space, if they're like physically like interacting with him, they speak in long, like storytelling sort of monologue, as do the characters in the game. And it felt like one of the things that Misfit sort of was grasping for throughout this experience, what he was lacking in real life, and what he like sought to sort of juxtapose from the game onto the real world, was that in the game his efforts made sense, and so like the desire of people within the world to make sense of their surroundings and to act on those is something that is always undermined by the fact that the real world is too complicated, and our agency is never as complete as we believe, as we have to believe in order to act. Right. But in the game, he was able to act and make real change. And that was something that he kept on returning to. And I wondered, is that something that is only found in games, or is that something that, like, and maybe you want to take this question in a different direction, but that was something that I saw Misfits stuck on, and
I hope it's not only found in games. If I hope that there's a way to make sense of our real lives and to kind of, I hope there's a way to make our lives the way we want them to be, if that makes any sense.
It's well, and the point that you're making, Chris, I think it's interesting to think about that in relationship, for instance, to there's a sequence where Misfit he has a conversation with the judge, and the judge says that he has this son that they lost in the fire, and Misfit decides he's going to go rescue the son, and of course
Yes.
doesn't rescue the son and fails miserably, and I wonder if the fault there. If there is a fault, I wonder. I mean, there are different ways that you could read that. Like that's this really striking instance where he does attempt to make positive, to do something positive, and to take action and agency, and fails. And is it a noble failure? Is his mistake in thinking that he can take action, or is his mistake in doing so without more consideration, without an appropriate sense of the reality of the circumstance and the actual possibility of what can be done? Or is there no mistake there? Is there no fault? Is that in fact a virtuous action, even in spite of its ultimate failure?
I mean, Patrick, do you I think personally, I think that it's virtuous. I think that I think that you can't replace later in the novella Stever is stuck in a K-hole and he's talking about
Oh man. Seriously.
I very succinctly described what it actually occurred and is occurring in the novella at that point. Stever is stuck in a K-hole. And he's basically like cycling and circling and unable to kind of get out of this like thought pattern where like he's looking at the world around him, but he feels like he can only see what like he says you won't see the thing driving the engine forward, you see the aftermath. And it's sort of like in a way I guess like I felt like that was expressing this lack of control, this lack of connection to meaning in the real world that is inescapable and permeates everything. But I also feel like there is, personally, I think there's nothing more important we can do, no, nothing more important for us to do than to resist that, than to seek or to continue to seek meaning, to continue to try to express through art and to try to make changes that are good, like saving the judge's son. Even if it is impossible. So I think of it as virtuous, but maybe Patrick feels differently.
No, I don't, I mean, I don't necessarily want to pronounce and say what, like, this has to be, you know,
Sure,
this,
sure.
you know, but from my perspective, it's, you know, I really wanted the novella to be funny. And I hope that it's, I wanted it to be funny in a really dark way. And so, like, I hope that scene where he's trying to save the son is doing the double duty of, like, you know, this guy is delusional. He really doesn't have a super good grasp of what of what it would take to save the son, but
it's not even totally clear that the person in the building is the son.
Right. I never really, when I was writing it, I remember wanting to keep it ambiguous, and to be honest, I don't even know if it's the son or if it's somebody else. Could be either one, but yeah, I hope that that scene kind of does a double function of, you know, maybe expanding him as a character, expanding him as a kind of a jester or of the cosmos, or a scapegoat of the cosmos, and at the same time to depict him as virtuous, if that's the word we want to use. I didn't necessarily think of that word, but definitely I hope that his action to try to save the son has some merit.
Is there, because it feels like Quixote is brought up by a character later in the novel, and that character, Freddy, seems to suggest, I might be reading this a little bit differently, but it seems to be suggesting that Quixote is actually freed by his fantasies. And my reading of Misfit is that he's sort of not freed by them. I don't know if I would say he's like trapped or stuck or unable to translate them meaningfully onto the real world. But I wondered, is there a difference between Quixote's context and Misfit's context that would help us understand Misfit? Or is there something shared between them that we should be like attaching to Misfit and reading in his experience, in his actions rather?
I hadn't necessarily thought of the idea of fantasy freeing either one, but I definitely wanted Misfit to be a Quixotean character. I remember I started to read Don Quixote about the time that I started to write this, and you know, I just really love the interpolated story. It's one of my favorite fiction techniques, and it's all throughout Don Quixote, and I think it's used wonderfully in that novel. So part of it was, you know, I was just really interested in that as a technique. But I also wanted to kind of talk about how, you know, both Misfit and Quixote are, they're fools. They're deluded guys who don't really understand much about what's going on in the world around them, but they both have an inherent sense of justice and fairness, that and they both want to work toward that. And in lieu, because of social structures and other things and other obstacles, they don't really know how to work towards justice and fairness, except through fantasy, except through like these delusions, you know?
Well, and the interesting thing about I don't know if there's something to be found here, but thinking about Quixote, the thing that makes Quixote a comical character is that he doesn't understand that his fantasies are fantasies, right? The thing that makes him a comical character is that he acts his fantasies out in the real world in a very unselfconscious and oblivious way. Whereas Misfit has his fantasies very consciously and deliberately quarantined. And I don't know, and that might be part of why, I mean, even though this is, you know, this is darkly funny in certain ways, but it also, that greater sense of the boundary that Misfit has between reality and fantasy keeps it to some extent from being overtly comical in the way that something like Quixote is.
Right, that's absolutely true.
The way it, there's a level of tragedy that comes from his understanding that his fantasies are fantasies.
That's definitely true.
You mentioned the interpolated stories, and that ties to something that I was thinking a little bit about. There are In many ways, this is a reasonably pretty well within the canon of the realist work, right? But then in, there are certain small ways in which maybe it starts to creep away from not quite being a piece of realist fiction. And the interpolated stories are one of those, I think. The way that these characters have these kinds of detailed monologues. The other thing that I was thinking about, there are certain things the narrator does, the way the narrator uses his or her omniscience. There's a little bit of a... There's some interesting things that you do with what the narrator does and doesn't know, and I do want to return to those in a bit. But that is a little bit peripheral to the question that I was trying to form, which was how did you decide to incorporate the elements that might be a little bit less realist, and how did you kind of strike that balance between the realist and non-realist elements when you were working on the piece?
You know, that's interesting, because when you say that it's a realist novel, I was writing it with under the impression that it was not a realist novella.
I mean, if it helps clarify, I guess the things I thought of as non-realist basically were the, I guess as much as anything, the interpolated stories and then just the sheer scale of the fire. I don't know. Relative to what happened in, I guess relative to what happened in California last year, maybe that's, you know, maybe that, I feel weirder now saying that that is non-realist than I would have 2 years ago.
Well, maybe,
I don't think that the fire, the scale, or the like irrational, unrealistic scale of the fire, I don't think that's meant to make any kind of comment about climate change or anything. It's a basic condition for the novel that, you know, it's the first thing that happens, so it's just kind of central to the ground rules of that world is that the whole city's on fire.
Right. And you know, the city is Cincinnati. It's where I live. So I think maybe if you're familiar with Cincinnati, you would know that, you know, there's really no way for the whole thing to catch on fire. I don't see how it could happen, you know.
Not in 2019.
Right, exactly. So I guess that's why I was under the impression that I was not writing a realist novel. But I also agree that mostly it is a realist novel, except for the fire and the monologues, which, you know, nobody's going to be able to, you know, tell these detailed stories. And, you know, assuming that the monologues that come from characters within the game come from Misfit, I'm not sure that that's true, but let's say that it is.
Sure.
Assuming they come from Misfit, you know, nobody has fantasies that are that detailed either. So I agree with you that it's mostly realist except for these little kind of things that are just meant to be metaphorical. And, you know, the fire itself is just, it's just a metaphor for, you know, all the things we struggle against, right? You know,
right,
addiction,
right.
You know, social problems, whatever.
Even though, I mean, it's a metaphor for addiction and social problems, although in practice what happens in the novel is like, oh man, I have addiction and social problems, and oh god, now I've got this fucking fire too. You know? he's put in the unfortunate position of having to deal with both the literal social problems and the metaphor for the social problems, like doubling up on him at the same time, which is quite unfair.
Oh man. I didn't think about that. Yeah, that was really shitty of me to treat Misfit that way.
Yeah. Well, it's not you, it's the universe, I guess. But
right, yeah.
Do you think of this as a pessimistic or optimistic novel? Do you think of it on that spectrum at all, given Misfit's arc? Because he starts from such a low place. Any elevation at all is kind
of
optimistic.
This heroic pessimism.
Could you like expand heroic on that?
Yeah, so okay, so I was recently reading I've recently gotten into pessimism as a philosophy, and But I would say it's been short-lived because it made me way too depressed. So I've stopped reading. Seriously, I've like stopped reading pessimist philosophy because I'm just like, oh man, I just want to like end my life reading it. But in that short stint where I was reading it a lot for like a couple months, one book I read divided pessimism into like three distinct subcategories. One of which is heroic pessimism, and that is best kind of seen in the works of Camus, who, you know, says like in The Myth of Sisyphus that, you know, our lives are these long unending, you know, not unending, but these long bouts of toil and pain, and there's no God, and we die, and that's it. But there's a way to become greater than your toil. There's a way to become greater than the pain that you experience, and a way to become greater than your suffering. Mm-hmm. And so hope, I would think that this is the heroic version of pessimism. You know, some of the other versions of pessimism are, you know, like, you know, just kill yourself right now. There's, you know, like, you know.
So what is, for Misfit then, what is the way of becoming greater than that sorrow?
I don't know. I don't know. I have no idea what his way of overcoming it is, other than continuing on, refusing to commit suicide.
Right. Or encountering a moment of genuine kindness.
Right, yeah. A moment of genuine kindness is definitely something of importance, I would say.
There's an interesting, speaking of the ending and the way that the ending works, there's sort of an interesting thing that you do with narrative foreshadowing I'd mentioned earlier, and maybe it'll be fruitful to discuss this, maybe it won't, I don't know, but there's a, somewhere in maybe like the third quarter of the novel-ish, there's a bit of foreshadowing where the narrator says, if he lives beyond Mary's apartment and the cold river afterwards, yada yada, if he does not live, his body will sway on the surface of the river's current, right? And right. So that foreshadowing, the narrator knows enough to foreshadow this sort of a moment of indecision that Misfit has at the end of the novel about whether or not to kill himself.
Right.
So there's like foreshadowing, ambiguously foreshadowing this moment of uncertainty in a way where even the narrator doesn't totally seem to know which direction it's going to go. But then as the action of the novel catches up to and advances beyond that moment, he does, as it turns out, opt not to kill himself. He survives the river in that sense, at least for the moment, opts not to kill himself. And it was interesting to me that like, it's like the narrator could see a certain ways into the future, but only, you know, only a certain ways and no more so, until Misfit kind of caught up to that moment and made the decision for himself in that moment. It's like there's, the narrator is assuming, and I know that you don't believe in free will, but what it suggests is that there's like a certain kind of predetermined arc that takes him to that moment by the river. And and he exercises choice in that moment.
Mm-hmm.
Which, I mean, I suppose, you know, does he exercise choice, or does he continue in that moment when he decides not to kill himself, or does he just continue to carry out some predestined thing? You know, I don't know, but.
Well, I don't necessarily think that choice is contradictory to determinism.
Okay.
You know, so there are lots of people who are compatibilists who say we both have free will and our actions are determined. I'm not sure that I agree with that position, but all the same, you know, our choices are still within a determined sequence, right?
Well, it's
if
interesting.
That makes sense.
Yeah, and I mean, even though they don't think about it in a philosophical way, and maybe I'm misunderstanding things to say this, but if you think about it, most organized religions actually exist in a state of tension between determinism and free will, right?
Right.
Like in Christianity, absolutely, the concept of your choice as an individual is terrifically important. And also, it's equally important to say, well, let go and let God. God's going to decide everything. Right. There's this way in which in Christianity, and I would assume probably in any kind of organized religion, you have the moral philosophy is deeply reliant on the assumption of individual choice and free will, but the soothing, the comfort, the kind of mentally palliative role of that belief system is reliant on determinism. Mm. So I think that cognitive dissonance might be it's very deeply rooted in something about being human.
Mm-hmm. Sure. And I mean, on the subject of determinism and free will and whatnot, you know, so if we're, so to kind of in a roundabout way answer your question about what the narrator can know, and why the narrator can see to a certain point and not beyond it. Mm-hmm. So my personal belief is that determinism is real. We don't have free will. That doesn't mean that we don't make choices. Human beings still decide things. It's just that, you know, like our biochemistry, you know, determines what we're going to decide at any given moment. So we still make decisions. Our decisions do matter. It matters whether we decide to kill someone or not kill someone. It matters whether we decide to get a degree in mathematics or a degree in business. You know, those choices do definitely have effects that matter in our lives. It's just that, you know, I think that the idea of thinking that they're free doesn't make any sense.
Is there, but
while I do think that we live in a determined universe, I don't think we'll ever be in a position to predict the course of that universe. We'll never have enough data to be able to say, here, this person will decide this, and here, this person will decide this. We just will never be in that position. So I think the narrator is in a similar position to that. You know, he has enough data.
Yeah.
He or she or it has enough data to see so far. But then, you know, you get to a certain point, and there are too many variables. You can't see everywhere all at once.
Insofar as,
well, and that's actually the purpose of the simulation that we live in. We're a giant quantum computer that's intended to basically you can predict that. You just have to have a computer that is as large and complex as a universe, and that is what we live in.
We live in
somebody else's predictive software.
My understanding is that it's all about, it's a basically simulation where they're perfecting the perfect butthole, and they're just
personally,
fair
if
point.
We live in a simulation. I think that the simulation is devised by a fucked up mad scientist who couldn't get funding for his project, so he just went into a basement and built this rusty, fucked up machine. And, you know, he's like, I'm going to program this for a nightmare hell world. But I'm going to fuck with these people, this nightmare hell world. But the problem is his machine is fucked up because he couldn't get any funding. So it's even worse than he predicted. And he's in his laboratory like, oh, my God, what did I do?
I think it kind of stems off of what you're saying, because, like, Patrick, that is like what you return to, and you do it so well. But there's a kind of a Three Witches. I have a kind of a Three Witches and Macbeth question, I guess, is Misfit sort of condemned to this experience by his awareness of like how screwed up the world is? Or is that something, is his experience driving him to that? So like is he like poisoned by some knowledge that is given to him? Or hi, Izzy. My dog just visited me. I guess like it might be viewed as like a class question too. Like he's sort of struggling. He's living off of like unemployment. He doesn't engage with society. Is that something that has driven him, his lack of an ability to engage with society, to this sort of like very, very grim philosophy about the world, or has the grim philosophy pushed him that way, or is that a useful question?
I don't know.
You better not say it's not a useful question, because then Chris just wasted like 5 minutes of breath.
No, I think it's a useful question. I don't. I mean, I hope you know Hans started off this podcast by saying, you're glad that something with this much, merit or artistic integrity exists. And I don't think you said it outright, but I've at least from other conversations we've had, I feel like you believe the novel is hopeful, and I hope the novel is hopeful as well. So novella, excuse me. It's only
Yeah,
a hundred and
I do believe it's hopeful. I mean, I believe it's hopeful, and I believe that it's hopeful in a very, very grim context. I mean, I believe it's hopeful to the extent that, oh boy, it's hopeful in a way that's hard to state without seeming, I suppose, a little bit trite, maybe.
Right.
It's like the difference between, people say that you shouldn't be able to paraphrase a good poem, right? And
Good
you can,
poem.
a good poem, you shouldn't be able to paraphrase a good poem.
That
And
makes sense.
I can read this novel and come away with the sense that moments of kindness and noble intention can exist and be worthwhile in the context of tragedy and systemic oppression. Maybe oppression's not
True.
quite the right word, systemic dysfunction. I can read the novel
Okay.
and come away with that feeling from the novel in a very pure way. But if I were to just say, well, the thesis of this novel is that moments of kindness and noble intentions still exist in like that description
Right.
minimizes and reduces that awareness in the way that it's felt from reading the novel.
Right. And but I to answer your question, Chris, I hope that this philosophy, which may be the result of or the cause of his problems, Misfits' problems, I hope that the novel is critiquing that philosophy, even if on some level it accepts it.
Right, right.
It accepts that the universe is random and shitty, but hopefully moments of kindness and a passion for fairness and justice can mitigate its randomness and stupidity and cruelty.
There's one of the questions that I had was one of the questions I had pre-written speaks to that a little bit, right? Because when Mary breaks up with Misfit, she says that she's doing it because he screams and freaks out and talks about how fucked up the world is and how we've got to evolve and kill all the rich people. And it's like, on some level, he's probably, you can't blame him for taking that stand, but at the same time, how do you have that feeling? How do you acknowledge that truth and still function in the world in a way that doesn't alienate the people that you need to survive?
Right.
And I don't know what the answer is to that, other than mental compartmentalization. And
Right.
maybe
Yeah.
that's his, maybe that's his, Maybe that's his tragic flaw as a hero, is an inability to compartmentalize. And I say that sarcastically.
It's also, you know, my own personal belief is that I'm not against, you know, a violent revolution or anything like that. Not necessarily. Not like, I'm not against it, like, in principle. I'm not against using violence to free the oppressed. But in practice, it doesn't work as well as nonviolent resistance. It just doesn't. Like, there are all kinds of studies telling us that nonviolent resistance is more effective at even things so far as getting rid of a regime, an entire regime. Not just getting reforms put in place, but getting rid of a regime. Nonviolent resistance is more effective. So, you know, I agree with Misfit that yes, we should kill all the rich people and eat their bodies. Definitely. But, you know, if we actually want to secure positive change, then, you know, we have to work in the small moments. We have to work through nonviolent channels and things like that, and we have to work collectively. So,
like, on a gut level, if you think about all of recorded history, can you pick even one time when there was a violent revolution or a civil war that you would actually want to have lived through, or where you'd want to live in the society that resulted in the aftermath?
Right.
I can't think of any. I mean, the American Revolution gets glamorized a little bit that way, but I mean, I think that's based on a number of deep misunderstandings, but that's neither here nor there.
I agree. Totally agree. And, you know, it's just, you know, I'm not even saying that the novel is necessarily commenting on revolution. I'm more just kind of speaking, you know, from my own personal ideas, but
I think
you go ahead.
Well, and I was going to say too, I mean, my sense is that what Mary finds off-putting about Misfit isn't just that there's some violence in his rhetoric, but that he can't find some way to peacefully exist in the world in spite of injustice, right?
Right. He can't, he just can't, you know, he hasn't, in, you know, injustice is real, injustice needs to be dissented against, it needs to be, you know, reacted against, but, you know, just kind of a constant anger, undirected and, well, directed, but ineffectual and
right.
You know, that, who can live with that? You know, what if, I'm sure if like all I talked to Tracy about were like, we got to fucking kill the rich people, you know, I'm like, well, you know, well, we do talk about that all the time, but you know, if I just screamed all the time, you know, would she want to be with me? Probably not.
Probably not. No. Okay. Cool.
Is that it?
Yeah, that's what I had. I mean, those were the things that struck me as entry points for kind of talking about the themes, talking about the meaning. Chris, did you have any other points that you wanted to address?
Just a comment, I guess. I thought that the interpolated story at the end, Shichiro's, was amazing. So I just wanted to say, like,
awesome.
Particularly amazing. Yeah. And
I wanted to save the best for the last.
No, just the way that his father's situation progresses to the point where he beats his mother and sister to death in that moment,
Jesus,
is very good.
Yeah,
like it was. I think it really kind of like, Hans mentioned that you can't really, like, you can't explain the thesis of a good poem or a good essay or a good anything in just a few sentences, because that's a sign that it's too pat. And I think that actually that interpolated story is a good representation of why that's the case for this work, because at the center of it is this really irreducible moment, and I think it kind of gets at, sort of maybe reflects on like Misfit's choice to not commit suicide on the end. I mean, like, it's Shichiro's telling it to try and convince Misfit to not commit suicide, but I think that like the whatever choice Shichiro's father had in that moment, it's really hard to sort of like know what agency he had, you know, and it, or none, if we were to give the author any opinion in the matter. But it really, I think, like it really does sort of represent or illustrate for me that chaos in the moment of trauma and the I guess, like, because like the father is, you know, like running home, it seemed to me, to make sure that his mom and his sister hadn't committed suicide, and then they can't do it, and then he beats them to death. It was just really beautiful and terrible, and I thought it was great.
That shit was real. I mean, I didn't actually use any, basically I based that off of actual accounts that I'd read about the invasion of Okinawa, like, you know, actual people, you know, and I read one guy's, you know, some kind of 90-year-old survivor of it who talked about, you know, that happening. It was I remember it being harrowing when I read about it. It was you know, war is always fucked up. War is always fucked. And yeah. I don't know. I feel like I'm talking very shallowly. Like, I don't
you
know.
Try,
war is always fucked up.
Have you tried
up.
Making your voice yeah, deeper war. When you say the words that you're saying?
War is
yeah,
fucked.
See?
War.
Yeah. That gave it gravity.
Yeah. So, yeah. Yeah, I'm glad you liked that, Chris. I was hoping, you know, I wanted that to be a really powerful, important story. And interestingly, it might even be like the least, I don't know. I feel like with the other stories, I was really trying to do something philosophical and thematic. And with that one, it was more like, I don't know exactly what I was trying to do with that.
I think it's just naked suffering and an inability to control your situation. Which I think is maybe, even if it's not espousing a specific philosophical viewpoint, to me, it maybe it had less dressing, and for that reason, maybe was a more sincere, for me, representation of what Misfit finds so frustrating with the real world.
Mm, sure. Yeah, that makes sense. All right, gentlemen. Well, if there are no more questions, you know, we can close things out. And I really appreciate you guys doing this. You know, I really appreciate you guys reading it. Hans, you have been, you know, there for me for, it seems like years now. I've been sending you this novella, and you've been, you know, offering feedback on numerous drafts. I really appreciate you for that, buddy. And, you know, Chris, I'm thank you for reading it, joining the podcast, and you know, just, you know, talking about it. So, I believe it's your turn, Chris, to pick the next book. What are we doing?
I kind of want to say thank you for having me read it. I really liked it. So.
Oh, good, good. I'm glad you enjoyed it. I was kind of worried that you would not like it and then you'd have to join the podcast and be like, yeah, this sucked.
Sort of,
you know. I guess that would have lent an interesting tension to the
sort of.
Proceedings, but
I mean, it would. I just assume, like, if you didn't like it, I assumed you would have been silent and awkward, and that would have sucked.
Well,
so,
you know, sort of like how I was with the goldfinch, maybe. I don't know, but
you weren't silent and awkward, but you know, you did tell us that you hated.
I hated
narrator. What's
narrator,
his name?
Yeah. Well,
the narrator.
I respect the book. I was really, so for my choice, I really want to reread Gilead, Catherine Robinson.
Gilead.
Maryland Robinson.
Sorry.
Maryland Robinson.
Would you guys want to?
That'll be a reread for all.
Yeah, I know we all read it for.
Reread for all of us.
Was it?
Actually, I think I may have skipped some.
Jerry
some
Brightwell's
chapters.
Class?
Yeah, in Jerry Bramwell's class. I may have skipped some chapters of that. I remember being bored with it, but
I remember thinking I should have been bored with it, but loving it and not really understanding why I loved it. And I was kind of just sort of perusing like my shelf and then like Googling like best books of the last 20 years just to kind of like jog my memory about like what I might have wanted to read. And it came up a few times, and I remembered loving it, and I remembered also being like really confused about like what about it was successful, maybe that's a good thing to unpack.
I remember finding it very interesting because like I don't know if there's any way I can say this without sounding like a shallow doofus, but like I came into, when I started grad school, I still had, you know, like I still had this kind of rock fans assumption that like in the realm of rock music, any music made by Christians automatically sucks.
Right.
And so I sort of went into literature with the assumption equally that all literature made by Christians also automatically sucks. So it was very disorienting to like that book.
I think I went at it with a bad attitude, similar to maybe something like Hans had it. You know, I'm not saying you Hans went into it with a bad attitude, but
I
went into it, you know, like this book's not about social justice. Nobody
it
nobody
still isn't. It still
about
isn't
social
Patrick,
justice.
So that's
and
not changed.
Yeah, I know.
There's not even
that's okay.
There's not even one single solitary wizard in this fucking book.
God damn it, man. If there's no fucking wizards, like, come on. That's
no wizards,
bullshit.
No wizards, yeah. No social justice, and no tits.
I mean, and Misfit has both. Has wizards and social justice.
Yeah.
Jesus.
That's maybe.
So it's going to be a real
I think
that's
why I'm picking
week.
Gilead, actually.
So I just wanted to say, Chris, that, you know, I think first time around I went into it with a bad attitude. And I've been trying to like expand my horizons and go into things with a more positive attitude. And I bet you that I'm actually going to like Gilead this time around because I think I'm less uptight and like books don't always have to be about social justice for me to like them.
I think it might be a good, interesting contrast to, Misfit the Wanderer actually like following it because the protagonist presupposes a meaning to the universe, but is confronted with a situation that is extremely trying and difficult so I don't know that I want to read it again, so I'm happy if you guys are willing to do that with me and talk about it.
Absolutely.
Yeah, no problem.
Excellent. All right, I'm looking forward to it, gentlemen. Thank you for coming on the podcast. Everybody, thank you for listening. If you want a copy of Misfit the Wanderer, All you got to do is go to kidraconis.org, kidraconis.org, and go to our order a book page and, you know, give us your information, and I'll send you one here in like a week when the print run comes to my house. All right. Peace out, everybody.